We're doing a get of Shiraigon, and we had seen that that Rebbe had chosen the Mishnah of Rabbi Meir, who was a disciple of Rabbi Akiva, and we discussed the greatness of Rabbi Akiva, that even Adam HaRishon rejoiced when God foretold him that Rabbi Akiva would come out from him, would be one of his descendants. We discussed that the disciples of Rabbi Akiva are those that composed all the Stam Mishnah Rabbi Meir, Stam Tosefta Rabbi Nechemiah, Stam Sefra Rabbi Yehuda, Stam Sefri Rabbi Shimon, and all of them were the disciples of Rabbi Akiva. And then we went on to say that all the other Braisos that are quoted, all the other Tanoic quotes, we don't give them as much weight because the good students of Rabbi Akiva, they had a very good tradition, and we give their quotes the most weight. And we left off, we were about to enter a new discussion. And we'll begin it again now. We know that Tanoim defines a generation, a time period. The period from the end of the Second Temple through Rabbi Meir is the period of Tanoim. Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Chia, and then their disciples, Rav, Shmuel, they already begin the generation of Amoraim. So, how does it work? Let's take Hillel. Hillel said something. Does that automatically become a Mishnah? So, in order for something to become a Mishnah, it had to really be placed into the Mishnah. Sometimes the Gemara is just going to quote something that a Tana said. So-and-so said like this, so-and-so said like that. That's not a Mishnah. Now, what's the difference whether it was quoted in a Mishnah or not? So, ordinarily, what we need to know is that an Amora will not argue on a Tana. An Amora, someone in the Gemara, assumes that everyone in the Mishnah knew so much more than them that they'll never argue with a Tana. And if you quote to them a Tana that said something that contradicts what they said, or if you point out that we can discern from something a Tana said that he wouldn't have agreed with the statement of an Amora, so the Amora will rescind his statement. He'll say, okay, you've proven me wrong. He won't argue with the Tana. So common knowledge holds that an Amora cannot argue with a Tana. So when you're discussing this with people, if you don't want to sound like fools, so you should be able to repeat what everyone else knows, takes as a given. An Amora cannot argue on a Tana. But now we're going to destroy that. So I'm going to tell you something that most people don't know. And that is that an Amora can argue on a Tana. We just assume that he won't. We assume that if he would have only known what the Tana said, he would have said, I take it back. So that's why we question what the Amoraim say. All the time the Gemara says, how could so-and-so have said this? But we have a Tana I quote this way, a Tana I quote that way. When we have two opinions in the Amoraim, how do we come to a conclusion? How do we prove one is right and one is wrong? We use Tanaic quotes. But this is only an assumption. Sometimes an Amora could be present and he'll be quoted a Braisa, a Mishnah that says an opinion one way. And then they ask the Amora, what do you do with that? And the Amora will say, oh, that's a misquote. Change the quote in the Mishnah. Change the version you have in the Mishnah. That's not a good version you have in the Mishnah. That's not a good version you have in the Braisa. Meaning, sometimes the Amora will say, my tradition is so strong and dates back to Tanaim, so that when you tell me that, I don't have to discard my opinion. Discard that quote. Change the quote. Now, this assumption that we assume throughout the Gemara, that an Amora will not argue on a Tana, that's only true when the words of the Tanaim have been filtered and the rabbis analyzed them and chose to include them in a Mishnah or a Braisa. Let's say we have a quote. Hillel says like this. We have quotes in the Gemara that they quote Yonah. You know Yonah the prophet, Jonah, lived in the time of the first temple. So you have a Gemara that quotes Yonah on there, quotes Jonah. They had a tradition dating back to Jonah. He had an opinion on something, so they quoted him. But if it's not quoted in a Mishnah, then it has less strength. It means he said it, but that doesn't mean that the rabbis accepted it and included it in the Mishnah. And then there are those that say that an Amora would argue with a Tana. Not only could an Amora argue with a Tana, but that an Amora would argue with a Tana. The only time that he wouldn't is when it was included in the Mishnah. Now this isn't well known. This is written by Rav Elchanan Wasserman, and he proves it from our letter, from Rav Shuir Agon. But if you tell it to people, they get very upset at you. They'll say, no, you misunderstood. It's not like that. Most people don't know this. So we have to know it. So when we're discussing the Mishnayot and the Braitot, we have to know that Rav Shri Agon over here discerned between the Braitot that were disciples of Rabbi Akiva, like we said, Safra, Sifri, Tosefta, and the other Braitot. And we have to add another level, and that is Tanai quotes that don't even enter Mishnah or a Braisa. Rabbi Shimon told his students, "My sons, learn my way of learning, because my way of learning is the best way of learning that was taken down from Rabbi Akiva." And we discussed that the Gemara says the hearts of the earlier generations were like the entrance to the Ulam, and the earlier generations is a reference to Rabbi Akiva. So we see that everyone looked at Rabbi Akiva and said, he's got it. Think about it. Rabbi Akiva is a man who started learning at age 40. At age 40, he didn't know Aleph Beis, didn't know how to read. That's when he started learning. He was up to his second marriage at age 40. He lost his first wife. He was up to his second marriage. He already had a son, Rabbi Shua ben Korcha. The Gemara says that Rabbi Dosa ben Arkinas, when he met Rabbi Akiva, he said to him, "Are you Akiva, the son of Yosef, that you're known all around the world?" Now, Rabbi Meir's student, Rabbi Meir, was the top student of Rabbi Akiva. The Gemara says that everyone got it was clear before heavens that there are none in Rabbi Meir's generation like him, but the halacha wasn't established like Rabbi Meir because they couldn't always know what he meant. He was too sharp. Now the Gemara, now Rav Shri Agon is going to enter a new arena, and that is the area of discussing the arguments that are quoted in the Mishnah. Rebbe arranged the Mishnah, and he rearranged it the way he saw fit. Part of what he did when he rearranged it was that some things that were minority opinion, he gave them the strength of the majority opinion because his high court was in on it with him. And the high court ruled like a certain minority opinions, then in the Mishnah was presented as Chachamim Omrim, our sages say. It was given majority opinion, even though really it was a minority's opinion. But because all the sages in Rebbe's generation agreed with it, so now it got majority opinion. He also added explanations to the Mishnah, and if there was something that everyone knew but Rebbe and his court was going to rule differently, and there were many people who had a tradition the other way, so then Rebbe would include that opinion even though he didn't want to rule like it. And that's why we have the Mishnah ask the following: why is it that we mention the minority opinion amongst when we have a majority opinion and we know that we're going to rule with the majority opinion? Right? Why don't the Mishnahis just give me bottom line? Why do the Mishnahis include the minority opinion? So Rabbi Yehuda teaches us that Rebbe wanted to ensure that if someone walks in, we suddenly discover a congregation out in Yemen, and they walk in and they say, "We have such a tradition." So we won't tell them, "You guys are whack. You guys have no tradition." We'll tell them, "No, you're going with the minority opinion." So Rebbe, in including the minority opinion in the Mishnah, ensured that if there were people who followed that minority opinion, we'd accept them. For example, we know that in Rabbi Yossi's town, they used to eat meat with milk. Chicken meat with milk, because that's how he ruled. That's permitted. Okay, but chicken meat we rule is forbidden, and he ruled it was permitted. In Rabbi Lezer's town, if they had a bris milah on Shabbos, they'd chop down the trees and they'd make the knife from scratch, because Rabbi Eliezer held that you're allowed to do all the preparations for a bris milah on Shabbos, not only the actual milah, but all the preparations. So in his town, that was the custom. If they'd have a bris milah, in order to show that's the halacha, they'd go hacking down trees on Shabbos, which is biblically prohibited. We hold it's biblically prohibited. He held it's a mitzvah. They'd prepare the knife from scratch and do bris milah on Shabbos. If someone would walk in and tell us they do that, we'd tell them, "Hey, you're missing something. That's not the halacha." So Rebbe included the minority opinion in the Mishnah so that when people would come in with different customs, we'll know where they're coming from.
What does chopping trees have to do with making a knife?
You have to make a knife. So you have to make a flame in order to melt the metal in order to make the knife. So they lit a fire, they chopped down the trees, they did everything you need to make a bris milah on Shabbos.
Why you should do this? You can't
So they did it to show how much we love the mitzvah of milah, that the Torah values the mitzvah of milah so much that the Torah permitted us to do all these preparations, and they held this was part of the mitzvah, this part of the way we honor the mitzvah of milah.
I have a question. I wasn't sure, and the guy went up when actually the people were supposed to take the Torah out of the Torah, and he started to scream, "Who wanna buy the place to read the Torah?" Like, he started to scream, "Me'er Shkalim," then he went down. Like, you know, Shabbos, they were like selling the place to the Torah, and this, making business on Shabbos.
So, the Sfaradim and Hasidim have the custom that they sell Aliyot on Shabbat, and they also sell the right to take out the Sefer Torah. And we say that even though we're not supposed to do business on Shabbos, but to raise money for tzedakah or for a mitzvah, that we do do. So, they're raising money for the shul. No one's around before Shabbos. And the people aren't as interested. Now it's Shabbos morning, and he knows he might get the Aliyah of Chazak. So we encourage him, we say, who wants the Aliyah of Chazak? His kid is there, and his kid says, "Daddy, buy me the right to put on the bells on the Sefer Torah, the crown." So the guy will pay for it now. Earlier, you wouldn't get the same money for it.
Yeah, but isn't it also kind of like a person who doesn't have money can't go up to the Torah? Or what? Like, I think to serve Hashem is not about money.
So if a person doesn't have money, he should find out, like me, where he could get an aliyah without money. He doesn't have to go to that shul. There are other shuls, and even within the same shul, there are other minyanim.
The area was the only shul. I was supposed to go out, but he said there's no shul around. So,
so there are other minyanim. It's not the only minyan.
I think it's not right, because like you shouldn't, like emunat Hashem, it's not about money. I don't see any
think about it differently. Where's the shul going to get its money from?
Oh, you didn't sell the shul. They don't need money anymore. And the other thing is, like, does the shul really need a lot of money?
Sure. Just air conditioning bills for a shul can run tens of thousands of shekel. Just air conditioning, without talking about arnona and water and cleaning it.
But then you just end up with a Shabbos.
People aren't going to give. If you tell someone, "I'm going to give you Maftir Yonah for your money," then I'll pay for it. We have to be practical.
Shuls is also working. We don't sell places.
So even Ashkenazi shuls sell their places on Yom Kippur, on the high holidays, and different places have different customs. That's their custom. It's an old custom.
But not in the moment. They sell it before, right?
No, they sell it. They sell it on Yom Kippur. I think that they're starting Arvit now. I know it's last week.